Hey everyone, this is Graham from Guru Focus. If you haven't met me already, I run our Value Investing Live series on YouTube. The podcast you're about to listen to was originally recorded live in front of an audience, so our guests may make references to charts and PowerPoint slides that you won't be able to see here. If you want to check out their full presentation, including those slides, or join our next live stream, click on the link down in the description. Now back to the podcast. All right. Welcome, everyone, to Value Investing Live. I am pleased to welcome our guest this week, Benj Gallander, the co-editor of the Contra the Herd Investment Letter, which has seen an 18.1% annualized return over the past 20 years. He is also the author of three best-selling books. Benj was also a regular on Bloomberg's BNN show and has appeared on CBC's On the Money. As always, for me, for those of you out in the audience, we do hope you'd post your questions and comments there in the chat. We are patiently waiting to go ahead and cruise through Benj's presentation here, and then we'll jump into those. If you are new here, let us know where you're coming from. We appreciate our international audience. We love to see where y'all are coming from. And like I said, feel free to post those questions and comments throughout. We will hold them until we get to the end of the presentation, and then we will go ahead and jump into that Q&A. That anything further from me, I'm going to go ahead and hand things over to Benj and we can jump into things.
All right. Well, appreciate that, Graham. Thank you so much for inviting me on. It's a great pleasure to be here. I was thinking of wearing a mask, but since I'm on my own, I don't really need it. Anyhow, I'm going to run you through what we do at Contra the Herd. We've been around for over 25 years, our methodology. I'm going to suggest a few stocks that you might be interested in, and there'll be questions afterwards. I want to thank you all for taking your time to be here today. I know most of you are probably busy people, although less busy perhaps with the pandemic. But even then, I know there's alternatives for you to do. So as you can see on the screen, I'm president of Contra the Herd Investment Letter. I've been investing for about 45 years, which I find kind of scary. I started when I was a teenager. Sometimes I still feel like a teenager, but sometimes I feel like the 64-year-old that I'll be tomorrow. So it certainly does vary from day to day. The letter, as I said, we've been doing for over 25 years. Our methodology has evolved somewhat, but overall, I'd say it's pretty much the same, and I do outline it in the two stock books that I've written. We can go into that a bit more afterwards. So without further ado, I'm going to go into our philosophies. We are indeed value investors. I'd say we're deep value investors, and we concentrate on turnaround situations and stocks which are currently unpopular but likely to regain popularity in the future. So what does that mean? One of the first things in the filter that I use are stocks that are down at least 33%, usually at down 50% in the past year, and are trading often towards the bottom of the past 10 years. Sometimes it's stock specific, but sometimes you have, such as happened in March 2020, where the market takes such a beating that tons of the stocks are down in value. And for us, times like that are often a good time to really do a lot of buying. We like it when things are beaten down to some degree, but we also like it in some ways when things are super hot like they are now, and hopefully we've done a bunch of selling. But we only invest, at least for the portfolio I manage, there's two. There's a vice president's portfolio, the Ben Stadelman and Phil McKellar manage, and the one I manage. The one I manage, all the stocks I buy have to have been around for at least 10 years. So nothing new, nothing exciting, no cryptos, that kind of thing. Has to be well-established companies that are beaten up. I focus on companies that have the ability to increase in value by a minimum 50%. Really, it's 100%. I don't look at the lower increases anymore as I used to. Often I'm looking at an upside of 200, 300, 400%. But that is always where stocks have traded in the past. There is nothing that we'll buy that hasn't traded at those much higher valuations. Again, they've been beaten down. So we know that they have a chance to get back up there if they return to form. So say one thing I like is when stocks have been beaten down and have traded at much higher levels for say 7 years, 7 of the 10 years, or I also like it when the chart is kind of wavy over the past 10 years, maybe it's oscillated up to much higher levels 3 times. So two examples of that, one is Bank of America that we've owned twice. The last time I bought it was after the financial crisis, and I bought it at $6 and change. I recently finished selling it at $38.74. So that's the kind of thing we look at. And we knew it had traded at much higher levels. We bought in at the same time as Warren Buffett did. As a matter of fact, in Canada, we were making news because Warren came out and said that we bought it and we did it like the day before. A stock that has waves is like Alpha Pro Tech, and that stock, they do health stuff, so it can be gloves, outfits, that kind of thing. They also do building membranes, and they tended to jump up in value whenever there was a health crisis, such as the one we're having now, such as H1N1, such as Ebola. It's a stock we bought under $2. It skied and went up to over $40. Unfortunately, we didn't hold it that high, but we did quite well on it. We carefully analyzed corporations' financial statements, concentrating on debt ratios and book values. So we're very much into financial statements. In my earlier, younger days of investing, sometimes I would buy stocks with too much debt. Generally, we try and avoid a lot of debt now. We love companies with clean balance sheets, no debt or nominal debt. We will sometimes buy some with more debt, but we like to see it coming down. So say, for example, the stock we bought yesterday, the debt load had come down $75 million over the past 2 weeks. So that's usually a healthy direction. We analyze management's ability to achieve stated returns. So often we talk with management. I like looking at old annual reports. 4 years ago, they said everything's going to be rosy, and then it wasn't. And those are non-pandemic times. So if the predictions are always rosy, well, then we discount what they're saying. If they're looking ahead and they say we're looking at some tough times and it happens, it has more credibility when they say things are going to be good. So that's key. We'll also often talk to management. Especially in Canada, where we're based, management's happy to talk to us. But even in the States, they certainly are often willing. And we've had things like we had with Franklin Covey, where we bought into the stock. We had not talked to management when it went up. Management found out it was us, and they wanted to know who we were, that kind of thing. About 50% of our portfolios are in Canada, and the rest are in the States. But we also have some that we buy in the States, but they have international, they're international companies such as Flextronics based in Singapore. We have a number of companies that way, one that I'll talk about in a little bit. Another I'll just mention is Orange Telecom, which is the largest telecom provider in France, but they're also in other countries. We only invest in organizations that have existed for 10 years. I alluded to that before. Again, that's specific to my portfolio. The vice president's portfolio does things in a slightly different way. It's still very contrarian, but they will buy some younger companies. We often pick takeover candidates well before takeovers occur for near optimal returns. So this is key. Virtually always when there's a takeover, it's done at a major premium. And it used to be year after year, we would have takeovers. Still happens almost every year. 1 year we had 5 takeovers. Now these are in portfolios that have 15 to 25 stocks. And when we just had one portfolio, even then, we would have sometimes 3 to 5 takeovers in a year. And often that's because other companies realize there's tremendous value there. The interesting thing is often they will not look at a takeover when the company's really beaten down, often when it's come back somewhat. And we find that's a little bit of a groupthink and management thinking. They don't want to go in when there's super bargains like we're looking at. Normally, we set sell targets or sell ranges all the time. And when it hits the target, we usually sell 50% upon achievement, often the 100%. It just depends. But there's some exceptions. We don't like to sell big winners in November and December because we like to defer taxes. So by deferring taxes, we keep the money in our pockets longer. But we find by setting a sell target, it grounds us. So we think that's very, very important. Two people don't know what to do, when to sell. And because there's so much information coming at us all the time, be it through the internet, a cell phone, television, whatever, and it's 24-hour media circus, people are much more likely to sell when they shouldn't be selling because of too much information. So one has to watch for all the noise. So I actually try and filter some of it out. We practice patient investing while ignoring the daily pulse of the market. Years ago, we did a survey. We looked at our research. We found we held for about 3.5 years on average. But we've held some stocks for over 10 years. Too specifically, we put a lot of money into the funeral home segment when it was badly beaten down. We love it when a sector's way out of favor. So we bought a lot of Service and Stewart. We held them both over 10 years, but the gains were 400% plus. In addition, we had dividends. So by holding that way, it's tremendously tax efficient. Those are still the exceptions. Normally, we don't hold that long, but we're happy to sit back and wait. You know, when I was on BNN Bloomberg regularly, Mark Bunting, who just interviewed me again for something else, he would say, how can you be so patient? And for us, it's very important. There's a lot of people who are buying and selling all the time, and we know that active traders do not do as well as passive traders. We advocate diversification. So what does diversification mean? We think it means 12 stocks normally plus. We always, for years, have had 15 to 25 in each portfolio. Sometimes there's a bit of an overlap. But in the portfolio I manage, I've had a lot of American bank stocks since the financial crisis. And about 35% of the portfolio was in American bank stocks. But there were 3 to 5 bank stocks there. Even now, over 30% of the portfolio is in bank stocks. But some of it is in one that I'm going to talk about today, which is Spanish. So some of the diversification is in different sectors, and we'll buy in any sector, that doesn't disturb us, but some of it is within a sector. We put our money where our mouth is by only notifying readers of the contra the herd investment letter of stocks we actually buy. So we focus on those. We publish quarterly, and we send it by snail mail. So people have something that's 16 to 20 pages. But whenever we buy or sell a stock, then we send it by email. So for example, we bought a stock yesterday, so we sent it out last night. And we'll say in our release, this price we paid, what was our sell range, why we like the stock, why we don't like the stock. So readers often ask us, excuse us, to manage their portfolios. We won't do it. We tell people what we do. They still have to be independent and decide to pull the trigger themselves. At the same time, we're happy to answer questions. You can see my email is in my left-hand corner here. You're welcome to send me emails on stocks or about Contra or other things, and I'm happy to answer them. Virtually always I get back to you within 48 hours. When we're looking to invest, we look to invest both in the micro level, the stocks, but also on the macro level. So both are very, very important to us. We limit our readership to 1,000 subscribers, We do not take over 1,000 people. you know, Ben and I met at the University of Western Ontario about 45 years ago. We're not in this to make millions of dollars, but we look to make a good living. We also make a lot of money by investing. By only having 1,000 subscribers, it allows us to interact with subscribers more, answer questions, and we're very happy to do that. It used to be we had 1,000 subscribers in a waiting list. At this point, we do not have 1,000 subscribers. So if you're interested in subscribing, now could be a time to do it. We also appreciate stocks that pay regular dividends. To me, dividends are very, very important. One thing I like to say is dividends allow me to be stupid longer. So if stocks that we own are not doing well, or specific stocks, if we're getting a dividend on it of 2, 3, 4, 5%, that's great because at least we're getting some return. The last stock I bought from my portfolio was about a month ago. Fortunately, it's gone up about 10%, but it also pays a dividend of about 8%. And we think that dividend is very, very secure. Now, that doesn't mean that it is, but indications are that it is. So if we can, again, even if the stock doesn't move, getting a return of 8.5% is worthwhile. That's far less than the annualized return of the 18.1% that I've had for 20 years, but it helps to guarantee it. At the same time, you know, a lot of people act like they don't make any mistakes. We do. If you go to our website at contratheherd.com, it outlines what we've done for every year. And you'll see we've had losing years. Two of them were in 2000 and 2008. We've had a few other losing years too. We also had a period of 3 years where we didn't do less than 45% returns. I wish that would happen again. And this year, if it keeps on going, maybe it will. Of course, past returns are not necessarily indicative of future returns, but we feel good about where we're at, and we've done it a long time. We also acknowledge a responsibility to help others that are less fortunate. We just think it makes sense. So we do support some charities. You know, if you can, it's worthwhile to give back. So I'll go into three of the picks. One of them is Banco Santander, which is the biggest bank in Spain. I think they're the biggest in Brazil. They're in some other countries, including the States. This stock was badly beaten up. When I put it in the portfolio about a year ago, it was at a price of $2.05. So it's now about $4. I think it can double again. It's traded even higher than that. It's a beautifully run bank. Until this past year, it had never lost money. And this bank goes back to the 19th century. And it's just done very, very well. Huge, huge bank. It reminds me of when I bought Bank of America. I didn't think Bank of America would go under because it is the Bank of America. Santander is the Bank of Spain in many, many ways. When I was buying it way under book value. The share outstanding wasn't great. You'll see 0% held by insiders. They actually hold some, but it's minor league. I like buying into stocks where insiders hold quite a bit and also where they're acquiring more shares. In some cases, that doesn't happen. It's very rare I get to buy the perfect stock. You can see on the chart how much higher it's traded at and how it's rebounded nicely from the lows. So it's one of my favorite stocks. I think it still has a lot of upside. A beautifully run company. The next one is Gold Resource Corporation. I wish that I held more gold. I only hold two gold corporations. One is this and one is Orvana, which is a small gold company on the TSX, Toronto Stock Exchange, which has a couple mines, one in Bolivia and one in Spain. They're also going into Argentina. Gold Resource recently split into two companies. Their operations are primarily in Mexico. It's a well-run company. It has no debt. Insiders own about 1.4%. Again, they don't own a lot. Company rarely loses money. It pays a monthly dividend. So the dividend is nice, could pay more in the future. Annual dividend going forward is 1.4%. So again, this gives us a gold play. Gold has a good chance of continuing to go up with the American dollar going down. At the same time, certain countries like India, which do a lot of buying, they may buy less because they're having a lot of difficulties. And at one point, the government stalled the sales of gold. People in China like buying gold now. Gold can have a place in a lot of portfolios, but right now it has relatively new competition, from my way of thinking, in terms of cryptocurrencies. So for people who are looking at safety, I do not think of gold as safe, but I look at it as diversification. The reason I say it's not safe, years ago it traded at 850, went down about 250. It was trading over 2,000 and went down quite a ways. It's coming back up. But the competition from the cryptocurrencies is something indeed and has to be considered. So Black Diamond Group, for us, it's a play to some degree on oil and gas. They actually do shelters for oil and gas, but they've also got shelters too, education. When they had the fires here in Canada and Fort McMurray, they had them there. So it's done a beautiful recovery. It's another one I can see up over $10. In this case, you can see insiders own almost 25%. They have been big buyers recently. The company has been doing better. They have been expanding. I like management in this case. I think they're very straight-laced, know what they're doing. So I think the company also has quite a bit of upside still. It does have some debt. I'd like to see the debt load come down, but because they've been doing the takeover, it has not been happening. So Black Diamond's listed on the Toronto Stock Exchange. Again, for people who are looking to buy into Canada, we certainly own a lot of Canadian stocks. So to subscribe, it costs $680 a year. For US people, they don't have to pay tax on this. You can go to our website and subscribe at contratheherd.com. If there's any problems with it, sometimes we have a bit of a problem with Americans who subscribe. We do have American subscribers. Feel free to contact us. Again, we publish 4 times a year and send out emails 25 to 35 times in a normal year. These are two of my 3 best-selling books. The Uncommon Investor sold out. The Contrarian Investors 13 was put up by Penguin and also by Insomniac Press. You can order both books from our website, one for $40, two for $75. I'm happy to sign them and dedicate them. The Contrarian Investors 13 talks about our stock methodology. It outlines a system that we use. The reason the number is 13 is because it's an unlucky number. So I talk about 13 things we do at Contra to make things lucky. The black swan on the cover is something we put there before somebody else who became famous with black swans. So again, the book's done very, very well in both hardcover and paperback. And that's primarily it for the presentation. We can open it up for questions. I want to say, and I alluded to it, our methodology has stayed fairly standard, except over the 25 years or 26 years we've been doing Contra, the methodology has evolved to some degree. So we've tweaked it over time. We've expanded our personnel. Phil joined us about 8 years ago. Mark's been with us about 15 years. Lloyd Davis, who does some of our website and editing, has been with us 15 years or so. Bill's been with us about 5 years. It's been pretty much the same old team for a long time, and we're happy to say that nobody's left us. And it seems to work well. So why don't we open it up for questions, and I will leave it to you guys.
All righty. So we do have plenty of international hellos here as well that we'll go ahead and just shout out real quick. Coming from France, Slovakia, Switzerland, Amsterdam, all over the world. So great to have all of y'all international audience joining us to here today. We do have some questions rolling in now. For those of you out in the audience, do please feel free to go ahead and toss those questions in there and the chat, and we will do our best to go ahead and get to those today. First up today, question coming in asking, just based upon a curiosity, it looks like, how much cash or liquidity you're holding in this current environment?
Well, in the vice president's portfolio, they actually put the cash in. We started that one about 10 years ago. And I would guess, let me look and get you a more accurate number. Yeah, about half of the portfolio there is in cash, a bit less as of yesterday. In the portfolio I manage, we don't put cash there. It's all based strictly on stocks. I always have lots of cash on the sidelines. I wish that I had more invested right now, but one of the reasons that I don't is we took a lot of money off the table in January and February with the tremendous gains. I mentioned Bank of America. Another one's INO Data, which we bought at $2 and change and sold at $6 and change. Another's Cost that we bought under $2. And that one just went ballistic in the Wall Street bets. I wish I had held it when it went as high as $127, but I didn't. BlackBerry that we'd held for a number of years, it got caught up in the Wall Street bets too. So I sold 80% of the portfolio when that jumped. I have been slow to deploy money over the past year because stocks have been, for the most part, fairly high. I do think there's a reasonable chance that there'll be a stock market blow-off. I don't know when, but I've got lots of money on the sidelines. I also still have quite a bit of money invested in the market.
For sure. And on the note of that blowout, do you have any, I guess we'll call it, reasonable assumption for how big of a blowout we could be looking at? I know our users like to question whether we're hitting a, you know, early 2000s tech bubble type situation, anything like that?
In October 1999, our issue then, we wrote up valuations made absolutely no sense. And we compared two stocks, one that we had more corporation, a well-established corporation in the envelope printing business, with Commerce One that had, you know, mega billion-dollar valuation and no revenues. So we just looked at it and said it didn't make sense at all. In March of 2000, I was on Canada's number one radio show, and I was debating with a woman who was very smart. But she basically suggested we were in a new paradigm. And I said, there is no such thing as a new paradigm. What you have is new technologies. And of course, that was a time of new technologies. But we had written that we didn't think valuations made sense. And then markets got killed. Prior to blowout, last couple two, we've been pretty good a little early before 2008. How big will it be? I would think minimum 20% going down. Could be 20 to 50%, but it could be big. Now, on the counterbalance side, there is so much money that governments have put out there, the American government, trillions of dollars here and there. Canadian government is spending a fortune. Our deficit is looking to be 350, 400 billion plus. It used to be considered big when the annual deficit was 35 to 40 billion. We're just spending money and wasting money like it's going out of style. So that's going to continue to catalyze the market. We also have a lot of people who are getting like money for nothing, and they've decided to play, be it through Robinhood or something else. And they're in there playing. A lot of, you know, people in their 20s are playing it. What a lot of them haven't seen are major market blow-offs. They saw what happened with crypto last week. What happens is, you know, when there's market blow-offs, there's margin calls. A lot of people, I think, will have margin calls. We know that governments have huge debt loads. We know that interest rates are at historical lows, and that will not continue. Interest rates are going to go up. Housing prices have gone up like crazy in Canada and some degree in the States. And there has to be at some point cooling with interest rates going up. Inflation, as I've predicted for a while, it should rear its ugly head. We just saw that past month. I think there's going to be more, and governments are going to have to do something to cool it. So when it will happen, I don't know, but I'd say sooner rather than later.
Absolutely. And next question we have coming in here. If you are watching a position in your portfolio continue to go down, how do you decide to go ahead and get out of that position, if you even do?
Well, we're always monitoring positions all the time. We will take tax losses. I like taking tax losses at this time of year. We do most of our buying in December, especially for my portfolio. And I do it when people are doing their tax loss selling. So when people do that, that increases the supply of the stock. That allows us to buy at a lower price. So we will sometimes average down. We like to average down. We prefer to never have a stock go down, but of course that isn't the case. So I never put a stop loss. I think stop losses are stupid. The problem with stop losses is if you have a stop loss, I mean, people out there can actually see the stop losses. Plus, if you put it at, say, 10%, I would say most of the stocks we have gone down at some point 10%. So if I've got a trailing stop loss, I'm going to get sold out of virtually every position. But we're always watching them. If the fundamentals have changed, we will look to sell. Like right now, I'm looking to sell a couple things because I'm thinking of taking some losses. But yeah, you want to manage so at the end of the day, you've got more money in your pocket. That is absolutely critical. So playing the tax game is key.
Definitely. And another question coming in here, looking specifically to the letter. Do you offer a market fair value for the stocks that you're writing about there?
Do we offer a market fair value? Is that the question?
That it is.
I'm not sure when you say fair value relative to what? To what the stock should be trading at? I'm not clear on the question.
We'll go ahead and we'll put a pause there on that question and For our audience member out there that asking, if you would go ahead and post clarification there, we can go ahead and jump into it here in just a moment.
The thing that I'll say is, you know, we're always trying to buy undervalued stocks that have been beaten down. And again, we set a sell target. Probably doesn't answer the question. What's fair value? And you're going to come back at me with it. Perhaps book value is one indicator, but then if goodwill is too high, then book value is unrealistic. I hate goodwill on a balance sheet because if you buy a company for over its book value, then the goodwill goes on the balance sheet. So hypothetically, the more you pay, the higher the goodwill, which is an asset. So we've written about that in our Globe and Mail column saying that it doesn't make sense as a valuation. So what is fair value varies quite a bit. Anyhow, we could be adding more to that in a little bit.
For sure. And it looks like we just had a clarification coming in. Just saying, how would you know whether or not you're investing at a, you know, 3 times or 5 times kind of overvaluation of that stock versus coming in at an undervalue, so on and so forth?
Well, partially, again, we can look at book value. We can look where the stocks traded before. If stock markets have been killed, then we know often the stock getting killed. It's not stock specific. We can look at the actual sector. I mean, you know, the old expression is price is what you pay, value is what you get. So we're looking to pay less than the value. Now, sometimes we're wrong. Sometimes the stocks keep on going down. Sometimes we'll buy, not very often though, value traps. So, for example, the oil and gas sector right now, there's a lot of questions. You know, where's that going to go from here? Some people say it's in its death throes because of electric cars and alternative energies. Ben and I don't think that. Phil is leaning more towards that. If Phil's right, that means when we buy stocks in that sector, we could be overvaluing based on where the prices go. But here's where something's fascinating. You go back in the past year, and the price of a barrel of oil was negative. I looked at that, said, I've been investing for a very long time. I'd never seen anything like that. It made zero sense. So often, you know, where markets are makes no sense. I got talked to the university and didn't believe in, you know, the market being perfectly efficient. I had a debate with one of my professors in MBA and said, no, I completely disagree. At that point, I'd been investing for about 5 years. And one of the fellow students in my class who'd been a currency trader came back for his MBA. He said, Benji, as I was known at that time, why would you debate the professor? Why would you bother? And I had to at that point in time. Now I wouldn't bother, I don't think. You know, back in 87, when the market lost 22.4%, I believe, in one day, how can you say that's perfectly efficient? You wake up in the morning and the stock market's 22.4% higher. Someone could say, oh yeah, but that shows it's perfect. That's just bull. So, you know, value varies. I could put a value on a stock now, someone else could put a different value. Obviously, if that person is selling and it's not for tax reason, they don't see the same value that I do, plain and simple. And that's one of the reasons we can have such a huge percentage return.
And we do have a jumping ahead here in our list. We'll go ahead and toss this one out there since we've been hitting on it now. But do y'all employ a specific methodology for determining kind of your ideal fair value, I guess, or are there specific data points that you like to rely upon to hit that fair value number?
Absolutely. When if you decide to buy my book, or you just get a copy from the library or whatever, I have something called a point tally system, and that shows that I give 1 or 2 points for different things. So if I think the stock can go up one time, it gets 1 point, 4 times, 4 points. If I like management, that's worth a point. If I think there's a chance it'll get taken over, because often there's something in the news about companies possibly being taken over from a year or two ago, that's a point. If the debt level is fairly low, or non-existence, that can be 1 or 2 points. So I touch on a lot of things. Insider trading is worth a point. If the management owns a certain amount, if they own over 5%, I love to see that. If the sector, if I particularly like the sector, that can be worth a point. I even have a point in the system for just, you know, my spidey sense. I've been doing this for so long that if I feel that there's a reason that that stock should go up, I'll give you a point for that. I don't like to buy into a stock that has less than 10 in terms of a rating. If it has 15 or 16, so much the better. So it is very well spelt out in terms of what I'm looking at. So it's a chart. I have a spreadsheet. I have one spreadsheet for the Canadian stocks. I have two spreadsheets for the American stocks. I have a stock watch list. So I divide my stocks into, I used to play a lot of baseball, not during the pandemic, into what I call Christmas buys, triple A's and double A. Christmas buys is about 15 stocks that I'm most interested in. Triple A are stocks that I'm quite interested in, but a little less, and double A or less than that are the new stocks that have come on the list. I don't buy into any stocks that I have not watched for at least 6 months. So I want to try and make sure that I've got a very good feel for them. Often I don't buy into them for 3, 4, 5 years. Sometimes they can come off their bottom. They can be up 50% or 100%. Again, I'll still be looking at 100, 200, 300, 4% potential upside. I don't like to try and catch a falling knife. I like to see stabilization or a bit of an uptick. But in terms of the original question, yes, there's certain standards I look at. The point tally system is very, very specific. It's not perfect, but it's a very good indicator in terms of whether a stock is worth buying. And then what I do is I have a rotation. So I'm following the stocks all the time. If I see a stock in the AA and maybe the CEO saying, yeah, things have been tough, but things are looking good. We just paid down a bunch of debt, et cetera. I've watched it for 6 months already. That can go up to AAA. If there's certain factors that are particularly interesting, that stock can go from AAA to December buy. So it's a moving scale. If a stock was a triple buy, but the stock is was a December buy, but it has gone down for certain reasons in my mind, I'll move it down to a triple A. So it's fun. It follows my first book that was a bestseller about stocks, The Uncommon Investor. Again, it sold out. That was actually a book about stocks and baseball. So it was a family and friends who got together to watch the seventh game of the World Series between the Toronto Blue Jays and the New York Mets. So lots of baseball metaphors. You can probably gather who won since I'm from Toronto. And in it, I used a lot of the actual Major League Baseball players, but I had friends up to bat for the Blue Jays and hitting very well, friends and family members. So a bit of a fantasy, but also, truism in terms of some of the players.
Absolutely. And on a, I guess, continuation, since it seems like this system is relatively fluid and has some kind of flow over time to it, have you found it evolving over time? Specifically, when we hit the pandemic, did you feel, I guess, pressure to change that, or you were sticking to your guns for the most part?
No, I've pretty much stuck to my guns for a long time, but it does evolve a little bit. Things have changed. So literally, if you'd asked me 4 months ago about Wall Street Bets and Reddit, I would have known virtually nothing. And then when two of our stocks, as I said, Cost and BlackBerry, got caught up in it in a very positive way, I had to think, okay, what is this? So I took a good look at it, tried to understand it. So now it's of interest to me in terms of when I'm buying a stock, if they're looking at it a little bit, maybe it'll get caught up in another rush. So, to remain static and not change over time, that doesn't make any sense. To not take advantage of new technology doesn't make sense. The best way of learning is from mistakes, and I've made many mistakes over the years. You can also learn from what you do right. I also like asking people around me what they think. So when we hit the pandemic and stocks got absolutely thrashed, I was asking a lot of people that I know, who I have faith in, what they thought about the markets. And almost everybody said they were going to keep going down. So I thought that too. I wish I'd done a lot more buying, and I didn't. And that was a mistake then. But I'm surrounded by very, very smart people. And to me, it makes a lot of sense to talk to those people and get their inputs. I had never seen anything like the pandemic, given that the last one was in about 1918 with the Spanish flu, and that was much more severe. There'd been nothing like that in our lifetimes. And I also think it's fascinating because I think there was an overreaction to the pandemic to a degree because governments got so scared. So yes, there's certain things we have to do, social distancing, mask wearing, and a few other things, but a lot of money was wasted, and I think that's also a shame. But I've learned, I also think what's going to happen is there's going to be more call to arms for future pandemics because people are going to be more afraid. And this has been a fabulous opportunity for people and organizations to make money. So you can bet your bottom dollar that the pharmaceutical companies want the World Health Organization and other organizations yelling pandemic because they've made an absolute fortune in this. And a lot of organizations have too. And a lot of people have been given so much money, a lot of corporations so much money, that the call to arms for a pandemic can be very positive. Now, please don't think that I'm saying the pandemic itself is positive. It's just a lot of people have made money with it. I mean, I'm on the board of a company called Datametrics. And Datametrics is into artificial intelligence. They're also into COVID testing. And their revenues went up almost 300% in this past quarter, year over year, because they're doing so much COVID testing. How long that'll last, I don't know. But this is a small company listed on the Venture Exchange. I mean, I know it well because I'm on the board, but it's an example of one company that's done well. And it was a year ago, it was worth 2 cents, and right now it's about 25 cents. So where to go from here, I don't know. But you have certain companies making a lot of money because of the pandemic.
Definitely. And another question here from one of our usual viewers. We've hit on Bank of America a couple of times, and he's just curious to see some of your logic for going ahead and selling off some of those holdings.
Well, again, I generally sell some when it hits a target. It hit the target. I sold it all. I also thought there was a good chance it would keep going up, which it has. Virtually always I sell early, and I wish I could time it better. And we built something into the system, talking about system evolving, about 10 years ago to try and sell later. Part of the reason I was selling so much earlier in the year was because our stocks were doing fabulously, but also because I was afraid of stock market valuations. So I wanted to take money off the table. Now I still have 15 or 16 stocks in the portfolio. So there's still money there and quite a bit of money there, but it just made sense for me to do it. We still hold First United Corporation, FUNC, a bank in the States. It's done well for us. We still hold what I call FUSB, First US Bank. The symbol is FUSB. I think that stock can double from here. It's a beautifully, beautifully run bank. Both these banks pay a dividend. So, you know, I've sold part of the FUMC, but I held the rest because I think there's more upside. But typically, our companies continue to go up after we sell. Again, I wish I could tap the top penny. But it's happened, but it rarely happens.
Understood. And another question from one of our usual viewers here. What is your thought on the recent reverse repo market hitting $500 billion?
The reverse repo market?
Reverse repo market.
Yeah, I don't follow it.
All right.
So I can't. I can't comment on it. I probably say, I mean, when I was doing Business News Network, BNN Bloomberg, for almost 20 years, people would say that I would talk about my errors more than anybody else. Because a lot of people out there, they're promoting it all the time. But again, I think you learn from your errors. I would also say, I don't know, probably more than anybody else in television. I'm exaggerating, but I say it a lot. And often somebody would ask a question and say, you know, I don't know. But what I would do is I will do my research. And so many people ask me about stocks, and there's stocks often that I don't know.
Absolutely. And fair enough response there. If you don't know, you don't know. Looking down our list, we do have a couple of questions kind of hinting at this similar question here. So we'll go ahead and lump them together into one here. Overarching question being here, how do you go about sifting through so many different stocks and finding these opportunities? Obviously, there are tens of thousands of potential opportunities out there. How do you narrow them down to those, you know, potentially we'll call them 15, 20 December buy options?
Well, it used to be back in the old days before the internet and filters, I would literally sit down and look at every stock in the newspaper, the TSX, the NASDAQ, the Amex, and the Dow. And I would look at that stock, those stocks that were down 33% plus. And then what I would have to do is mail to companies and ask for their annual reports for the last 4 years and put me on their lists. So it took a lot more work, whereas now I just put them into a filter. The Globe and Mail used to have a tremendous filter, unfortunately, they don't now. So now I use some other filters, and it will do they will do the job for me. So that takes a lot of stocks out of the equations. Then I'll look at each of the companies that managed to survive the first cut to see that they've been around for 10 years. I'll look to see if they have at least 100% upside, if they've traded at much higher levels for a long time. And then I still email the company and ask them to send me information. I know I can get it all on the net, and I use the net a lot. And a lot of companies won't even send that information now. They say, just go on the internet. So, and then over time, the companies get weeded out again, or they get moved around in the different lists.
Absolutely. And as we're reaching the bottom of our list here of questions from the audience, what would be your advice on the capabilities of a person that they would need to be successful in the current investment management landscape?
I think a key is to read a lot and read diversely. I mean, all of us at Contra, we do an awful lot of reading. I read The Globe every day. I read Bloomberg. I read other magazines. I've read a ton of stock books. Matter of fact, there's bibliography in the Contrarian Investors 13 books that I think are really good books. Reading is absolutely critical. But often now reading and not reacting is critical. I do a lot of my reading on the internet. I get a lot of information sent to me. Sometimes people send me interesting articles. But, you know, I wrote six plays that were actually on the stage. And my production partner, Todd Virko, he would say, keep an open mind and you'll see what pops into it. And our company, a theater company, was called Open Mind Creative Productions. So I think you want to keep an open mind. You don't want to get too staid in terms of your way of thinking. And that's key. Listen to other people. I listen to people with completely different viewpoints than mine sometimes. Some of them I think are wackos to a degree, but it's good. I have a friend who I'll go walking with. I have one guy who I've known forever. When he tells me something, he gives me effectively often what's called a negative confirmation. If he thinks something, I've got a pretty good idea if I disagree that what he says is wrong. But he actually knows a lot of stuff. So that may sound kind of bizarre and negative confirmation, but there are. And again, talk widely to people. Don't be afraid to say what you don't know and ask for information on those things.
Definitely. Well, Benj, that is going to round out the questions that we have here today. It has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on, taking the time to go ahead and give us that great presentation and take all of these questions from our audience.
It's a pleasure, Graham. As I said, if people who didn't get a chance to ask questions, I know at the top of the hour, my email address, gall@pathcom.com. Can ask me whatever you want. I really appreciate you having me on, and again, I appreciate you all for watching.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to this episode of Value Investing Live. If you haven't joined one of our live streams before, check us out on YouTube and register for the events on gurufocus.com. If it's your first time hearing of us, click the link in the bio for a free 7-day trial of Guru Focus, where you can test out all of our great tools and features. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.